August of 1976, two bodies were discovered by a trucker on a dirt road in Sumter County, South Carolina. They had been murdered in cold blood and left exposed for anyone to find. It was evident that they were not from South Carolina, but the police had little to go on back then. Almost 45 years had passed with no leads on identifying the victims or their killer. It seemed as if the answers would never come. Two missing persons with families concerned of their whereabouts, and dwindling hope as the years went on, fearing that they would never get closure. That was, until recently. My name is Blake Mosley, and this is South Carolina Spook Show. Stay tuned.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
On the morning of August 9th, 1976, a trucker was traveling along Locklear Road in Sumter County, South Carolina, when he discovered the bodies of a young couple laying on the road's shoulder. At 6:20 a.m., the trucker, Martin Durant, contacted Charles Graham, an employee at a nearby store. Graham, in turn, contacted the authorities. The victims had both been shot to death with either a .38 caliber or a .357 Magnum pistol. The woman was shot in the chest and the man shot in the head. Their similar features made police believe that they may have been related, possibly siblings. They carried no identification. Earlier that day, a witness heard a car driving down a dirt road to where their bodies were later found. He heard gunshots and then heard the car drive quickly back onto the highway. In those early morning hours of August 9th, the young man and woman were said to have been seen from a distance by a hermit. It was said that they had been dropped off on Locklear Road, a secluded dirt road between I-95 and 341. The male victim had been shot 3 times in the upper chest, and the female victim was shot in the upper chest and through the neck. Investigators believe that the couple may have been well-to-do or from another country. They may have been hitchhiking across the United States or were the victims of a carjacking. No drugs or alcohol were found in their systems, and they were not wearing underwear and did not have any money on them. An autopsy revealed that they had recently eaten fruit and or ice cream, and a witness reported seeing a couple matching their description at a local fruit stand. Months after the couple's murder, an employee of a Santee, South Carolina campground claimed that he had met them weeks before their deaths. He said that the man's name was either Jock or Jacques, and that he and the woman were going to Florida. They soon became friends. He later said that he was the son of a doctor in Canada, and that he and the woman were on vacation. Following the couple's murder, their descriptions were sent across the country. Their fingerprints were also sent to the FBI and other law enforcement agencies. Although several possible identities were suggested, all were ruled out. For the following year, the couple's bodies were placed in airtight coffins with glass lids in a building behind a funeral home in hopes that someone would come in and identify them. However, that never took place. In 1977, they were buried in donated plots in the Bethel United Methodist Church Cemetery in Oswego. Neither they nor their killer or killers were ever identified. That is, until recently. It was announced on January 19, 2021, that both victims had been identified. A statement by the DNA Doe Project described the resolution of that case, and that they were withholding additional information, including the descendants' names. A news report published later in the day elaborated that the male victim was from Pennsylvania and the female was from Wisconsin. It was clarified the following day that the female was actually from the state of Minnesota. The male victim was at first believed to be between 18 and 22 years of age. The male victim was at first believed to be between 18 and 22 years old, but his dentition suggested that he may have been older than 27. The age range was updated to be between 18 and 30 years after his case was entered into the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System, or NAMIS. The forensic dentist who examined the man's teeth said that he believed he was over 27, but that he had looked younger due to his clothing and his build. The victim was white with an olive complexion. He had brown, shoulder-length hair, brown eyes, and very distinctive bushy eyebrows. He stood over 6 feet tall, weighed about 150 pounds, and had extensive, elaborate dental work that may have been performed outside of the United States. This might indicate a higher socioeconomic status. A unique type of root canal surgery had been performed during the man's life. It looked as if he had been midway through a complete dental restoration. In addition, the man had a 4-inch appendectomy scar. He also had various scars on his back and shoulders, which indicated frequent participation in some form of contact sport. He was wearing faded Levi brand jeans and a red t-shirt. The shirt read Coors, America's Light Beer, on the front, and Camel Challenger GT Sebring 75 on the back, along with the Snoopy design. The shirt was apparently a promotional item from the Sebring races held in Sebring, Florida, in 1975, which were sponsored by the Coors Brewing Company. He wore no underwear and carried a pack of Grant's Truck Stop matches in his pocket. The matches are believed to have come from a Grant's Truck Stop somewhere in the Midwest. He wore a gold Bulova wristwatch with a Twist-O-Flex band bearing the serial number H918803. Using this number, investigators were able to determine that Bulova had made the watch in 1968. But when the Bulova company downsized in the early 70s, they destroyed many of their records, meaning that there was no way to be certain where the victim's watch was distributed or bought. He wore a 14-karat gold ring set with a gray star sapphire stone. The initials JPF were engraved inside the ring, which had a Florentine finish. Both the ring and the watch were rather expensive. This, together with the man's elaborate dental work, suggested that he had come from an affluent family. The female victim was slightly younger than the man. She was originally thought to be between 18 and 20 years old. After her case was entered into NAMIS, her age estimate was increased to 18 to 25 years old. She stood at 5'5", weighed about 100 pounds, and had a slim build and an olive complexion like that of her companion. This led some observers to speculate that they may have been siblings. She had reddish-brown, shoulder-length hair and bluish-gray eyes, although some state that it was hazel. She had two distinctive moles on the left side of her face near her mouth. The coroner noted that the young woman had unusually long, natural eyelashes and that both victims were very clean and well-groomed. She had fillings in all of her back teeth, and her front teeth would have appeared straight even if she were to smile. She had no surgical scars, she had never been pregnant, and her legs had not been shaved. Unlike her male companion, no scars were found on her body. She was wearing an unbleached white muslin blouse over a pink front-tying halter top. She wore blue denim cut-off shorts, or Daisy Dukes, and she had a floral print scarf tied around her waist as a belt. She wore Strike Right brand wedge-heeled sandals that were lavender and hot pink in color. She wore three distinctive rings. The first ring was a black, oblong stone with what appeared to be small turquoise chips embedded in it. The second had an ornate scrolling feather shape with coral and turquoise stones. The third was a simple metal band with red, white, and blue stones. These rings appeared to be authentic handmade Native American or Mexican costume jewelry. They were all made of sterling silver, and they appeared to have originated in the southwestern United States. Like the man beside her, the female victim also wore no underwear. In 1977, a man named Lonnie George Henry was arrested in Lotta, South Carolina, for driving while intoxicated. He owned a revolver found in his vehicle of the same kind as the murder weapon. It was proven to be the murder weapon after it was test-fired by investigators. Henry, who died in 1982, was located but was not charged because insufficient evidence existed to file charges against this individual with the murders. Investigators then traveled to the city of Brunswick, Georgia. They met with a mother and a father who were thought to be possible acquaintances of the Jane Doe. Their daughter was missing, and her ex-boyfriend had reported a similarity between the female victim and his ex-girlfriend. However, after showing the parents of the missing woman photographs of the female victim, neither they nor her friends could verify that it was her. After a dental comparison, it was found that the two women did not match. As mentioned before, the initials JPF engraved inside the man's ring supported the theory that his name was Jacques, or at least that it started with a J. The book of matches found in the man's pocket provided a further clue. The matches came from a truck stop chain, which had locations in Idaho, Nebraska, and Arizona. After information was released to the public, a man from Nebraska stated that he may have performed repairs on a car with Oregon or Washington license plates whose owners matched the description of the victims, but this uncovered no additional leads. Some even speculate that notable serial killer Henry Lee Lucas could have been involved in the murders. Lucas himself told police that he had been in South Carolina the day that the victims died, but he was received with skepticism as he had a penchant for false confessions. He was never charged with the crime and died in 2001 due to heart failure. Earlier, Lucas had confessed to two murders that also happened in Sumter County, that of an elderly woman in 1975 and a young man in 1983. Like most other leads, this revealed no additional clues to the pair's names or their actual murderer. The couple's bodies were kept at a local funeral home in caskets with airtight, see-through lids in hopes that someone would identify them. People from all over the country called to inquire about them, including several parents of young runaways. Unfortunately, none were able to identify the bodies. The bodies remained on display until they began to deteriorate. On August 14th of 1977, 1 year and 5 days after the bodies were found, they were interred in Bethel United Methodist Church Cemetery in Oswego, South Carolina. Hundreds attended the funeral service. In addition, law enforcement agencies raised several hundred dollars to pay the funeral home. The graves had stone and granite markers which read, "Male unknown" and "Female unknown." It seemed as if the two victims would never be identified. But then, in 2007, both bodies were exhumed to obtain DNA information. This led to the theory of the pairs having been siblings being disproved. The testing showed that they were not genetically related, though they did resemble each other. The DNA Doe Project, an organization working to resolve unidentified descendant cases, was recruited in July of 2019 for assistance to identify the then unidentified couple. A total of $2,300 was donated to fund the extraction of usable DNA profiles from bone marrow for genetic genealogy research. On October 12, 2020, they released the results from their genealogical tests of the victims' ancestral backgrounds. In January of 2021, the organization announced that they had successfully aided with the victims' identifications as a pair of American hitchhikers. They were identified as Pamela Buckley and James Fruend on January 21, 2021 at a press conference. Fruend was last seen on December 25, 1975 in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Buckley, who was originally from Minnesota, was last seen in December of 1975 in Colorado Springs, Colorado, where she was also reported missing. Both victims' families were contacted by the Sumter County Sheriff's Office, and the families confirmed their identities. The relation of the two is still unknown. Matthew McDaniel, a Clemson resident who helped identify Buckley and Fruend and suggested the Sheriff's Office reach out to the DNA Doe Project in 2019, was glad that the more than 44-year-long mystery of their identities had finally come to an end. For the past 8 years, McDaniel dedicated himself to solving the case of the unidentified pair, and he said it was genetic genealogy that finally cracked it. He has shared research and a potential list of suspects with the Sumter County Sheriff's Office. Hopefully, justice will be served for James and Pamela, McDaniel said. Sumter County Sheriff Anthony Dennis said that he thinks this homicide was an isolated incident, and he did not wish to share much information regarding the homicide case, as the Sheriff's Office plans to delve back into the investigation. "We do have persons of interest," Dennis said. "We're definitely going to reopen the case, and we want to find out who actually committed these crimes." While the pair was identified, the mystery behind the circumstances of their awful murders is still unsolved. The investigation into the couple's deaths is ongoing, but on the positive side, their families finally know what happened to their missing loved ones. Thank you. Hey everyone, thank you again for checking out this episode of South Carolina Spook Show. I have gotten so much positive feedback on this thing. It's been so awesome for just a little fun project that I wanted to start to kind of turn into something more. It's really uplifting. I guess the biggest criticism that I have received is that you guys wish that the show was the episodes were longer. And as much as I would love to take the time to go into depth of some of these cases and stories, I just don't have the time. This is something that I can do on the side when I have a little bit of free time, and something I really enjoy doing. Podcasting has been a big part of my life for the past 3 or 4 years, and I love the research, I love the recording process, the editing, the uploading, the promotional stuff. Unfortunately, I just can't do it all the time. So maybe one day I'll be able to get to that point. I'm not quite there yet. But thank you so much again for checking this out. The first time that I came across the story of the Sumpter County Does was somewhere in 2007, 2008, something like that. I had a friend and some family members who actually went to church at Bethel United Methodist. And I was visiting the church one day, hanging out with my buddy, and he took me out to the cemetery to tell me the story about this unidentified couple that had been found, and they never figured out who they were or who killed them. And there was, you know, speculation that it might have been Pee-wee Gaskins that may have killed them. I had heard about the Henry Lee Lucas thing, so no one really knew what was going to come of all that. And it seemed like it was a case that would never be found out. And I remember in 2019, I was driving back from a training class in Columbia and was checking out new podcasts, and I was really starting to get into the whole true crime genre. And I was listening to Crime Junkies, and they talked about the Sumpter County Does. And I was like, oh yeah, I forgot all about those. So they kind of like re-sparked my interest in this case. And then to hear in 2021 that they had finally identified them was just so awesome. And I'm sure it was great closure for their families. And unfortunately, we haven't found who it was that murdered them. But hopefully that comes out maybe in the next few years. But shout out to McCathern for suggesting this episode. And congratulations to McCathern and Gabe. They were recently married, and we had a great time at their wedding. I am sorry that I did not get to perform an Eminem song with you, McCathern. I'll make it up to you eventually. Thank you for suggesting this show. You sent me a few of them, and I've got my work cut out for me for sure. I've got a whole list in my phone of the ones that you have suggested, and I will definitely be getting those episodes out in the near future. And if you guys have any of your own suggestions for shows, or you have your own personal stories, you can send them to me, and I will be glad to feature them in a future episode. You can email suggestions and stories to scspookshow@gmail.com, or if you want to send a message on any of the social media sites that I'm on for the show, it's Facebook and Instagram is at South Carolina Spook Show, and Twitter it's at scspookshow. And if you guys don't mind, if you could please share the show with friends and family who enjoy true crime or paranormal stories, and anybody that loves South Carolina history, maybe they'll enjoy this show. I'm on several platforms: Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Breaker, Pocket Cast, CastBox, Stitcher, and Radio Public. So if you know anybody that prefers those, please send them to them, and I would very much appreciate it. If you can leave a rating and review wherever you listen to this, if you're able to, I really would appreciate that. It will help this show grow into something more. Maybe I can make these episodes a little bit longer and have more time for them. And if you don't mind checking out my other podcast, it's called When Words Fail, Music Speaks. I do that with my buddy James Cox. It's all about fighting depression with the power of music. And it's a lot of fun. And we've got some really interesting episodes coming out. And I hope you guys enjoy that. Sources from this episode come from fandom.com, Wikipedia, The Sumpter Item, Fox Carolina, and grunge.com. Thank you again for checking this out. I am your creator and host, Blake Mosley. And this is South Carolina Spook Show. Y'all stay spooky.